It was the year of deep geeking.
The year of Feedbackapalooza.
The year we discussed our favorite show.
It was the year without Zima.
The year of great tequila.
The year of puns.
And a year of more interviews.
It was a new chance for fun.
It was the end of the series.
It was the year we made it to Crusade.
The year is 2009. The show, Babylon Podcast.
And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And we have Novorlon again. He left us. He stole away in the middle of the night on a secret mission back to the Vorlon homeworld.
Yeah, and we were going to go follow him, and then we realized that nobody ever comes back from that kind of a mission, so we decided to stick around. Hey, you know what? This is on a complete and utter tangent, but it just occurred to me. I went to the dentist today, okay, and I'm sitting there in the chair laying back. And I've been a good boy. I've been brushing. I've been flossing, taking care of my teeth, okay? And then it occurs to me, like all these science fiction stories where the guy goes off on, you know, like instantly with the aliens who want to take him away and show him the universe and the wonders that is the galaxy and blah, blah, blah. They never talk about grabbing a toothbrush. And you know what? I mean, like, I hope at some point in time he tells the aliens they need to synthesize this thing with a handle and bristles at the end, because otherwise, in about 3 years, man, he's going to be stinky, nasty breath. And that made me wonder. I'm trying to remember if there's ever a time in B5 where they showed toothbrushing going on.
Showed a lot of shaving. Showed a lot of face washing.
But using the bathroom.
Showers, yeah.
Yeah, showers, yeah. Right, exactly.
It showers, you had fasten zip.
Yeah, right.
I don't recall any overt displays of dental hygiene.
Yeah, I don't even recall seeing like a toothbrush in a holder in the bathroom. I can't say I've ever really paid attention. Like I said, this is after, 40-odd years of sitting in the dentist chair, this occurs to me today, so I don't know.
How do they do teeth brushing on Star Trek?
Well, they didn't do any hygiene or bodily functions in Star Trek.
No, I remember hair brushing.
Well, yeah, but that's more like beauty.
Okay.
Which is different than cleaning. Where's the toilet? So, you know, Star Trek was very super discreet about such things.
Okay.
We're in Starfleet. We don't need to bathe. I don't know. Well, you know, in the motion picture, the Ilea probe showed up in the sonic shower, so, you know, the implication is there. Yeah, how about Battlestar Galactica and all the gritty nastiness that was? Well, they had the shower. I'll take that back. Nope, and they had bathrooms. But they never showed toothbrushing either, did they?
No. Are our science fiction writers afraid to take that next step into the future of dental hygiene?
At least, at the very least, throw us a bone and say that in 2257, a dental procedure was created which, you know, allowed you to forego flossing. And no, because even with that, you got a brush. I mean, you're eating, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't imagine that spoo leaves you minty fresh.
Not to mention that if it's warm spoo and kind of like marshmallowy, it's going to get in between the teeth.
Right, exactly.
It's going to get down in there. And it doesn't last long. Doesn't keep very well. Doesn't keep very well. So,
you're right. Yeah.
So by 2259, has humankind progressed beyond bristles on a stick?
Yeah, maybe there's just a device.
I would like to know that.
Okay.
Because I know several. I remember my parents had the water pick.
Yeah, right.
When I was a kid, I thought that was the coolest thing ever. Yeah, could shoot my brother with it, too much to my mom's dismay. And I know some people who have the sonic toothbrushes, you know, the whatever right. They're called. And So have we progressed to some new form of technology that simplifies brushing, that has eliminated the need for toothpaste?
I don't know.
Is there a replacement for toothpaste?
And don't tell me spoo, because I'm not buying that.
No. And it's not like toothpaste goes bad. It's one of those mystical concoctions that, you know, you open, as long as the tube stays sealed, you know, 20 years later, you open it up, it'll probably still work.
So, yeah. I'm with you. Well, I think I can say that I've seen one of the most greatest advances in toothbrush technology. And what it was a toothbrush to help your kids brush for like the 2 minute length of time you're supposed to. And so you press the button and it plays the Star Wars theme for 2 minutes. And so while the Star Wars theme is going on, you're supposed to brush.
I thought it was pretty slick. I thought you were going to talk about the blue goo.
No, that's milk. That's Bantha milk or something. I don't know.
It's like, and it encourages your kids to brush because it turns their teeth blue and they can see where they need to brush. And so they play with it and spit the blue goo out and they go, ew, oh, cool. And then they clean it off their feet. Yeah. Off their teeth. So, yeah, I thought you were going to say that because that's just.
No, but that's a good idea.
That's a boy thing. That's definitely a boy thing.
Yeah. Okay. That's true.
I mean, I'm a tomboy and I go, ew, at that.
All right. Well, I thought it was cool.
Well, no. The blue goo. The other one.
Oh.
The geek thing is kind of cool. Yeah, the geek thing. Yeah, that's kind of neat. We have all some.
Right, well, go ahead.
Other news this week in Babylon 5 history. ISN aired 36 hours aboard Babylon 5 on September 16th, 2259.
A biting, insightful, and wholly truthful look at what went on in the course of a day and a half on the station.
Uh-huh, right.
Hey, look, I know a guy who works there, Philip Highcastle, and he wouldn't steer me wrong.
But I do have good news.
Yeah, what's that?
Remember that MIT had posted the video of JMS's Julius Schwartz lecture?
Yes.
And took it down like 2 days later.
Yes.
It has been reposted in three parts.
Woo.
So, yeah, the first time it was like a 700 meg single file. It was huge. This time it's been reposted as four separate MP4 files. One is the lecture itself. There's a separate file that's the Q&A with Henry Jenkins. And there's a separate Q&A with the audience.
Wow. Well, maybe that's why they took it down, is because they put the big, huge thing up there and it got crashed the servers when all these fanatics showed up to download it.
Yeah. All of the B5 fans found out, hit the server at the same time. The server screamed, cried mommy, and fell over.
Yeah.
that's my story and I'm sticking to it. But all three parts are available.
Right.
I don't have the link memorized, but it is on the website in the news section, babylonpodcast.com. So go check it out.
Okay.
Go download it. Go watch it. You can watch it online. And if somebody knows when the actual DVD of that's going to be available, let me know, because I can't find that information on their website at all.
Maybe they're just hoping posting it up in three parts will take care of that problem.
Well, no, they want to sell the DVD to be able to afford whoever next year's guest is for the lecture series. So that's what I'm talking about. But we're good.
Okay.
Time for geeking?
Well, I think so.
Okay. We'll take a really, really quick break and come back with deep geeking on actually one of my favorite season 5 episodes, The Ragged Edge. Mm-hmm.
Do you drool over cutting-edge technology? Are you the first in line for the latest sci-fi movie? Do you stay up late at night playing video games? Do you consider being called a geek a badge of honor? Then Geek Cred is the show for you. Join me, Steve Rickyberg, as I bring you in-depth behind-the-scenes interviews to give you the inside scoop on everything geek. From tech to sci-fi to games, you name it, we geek it. Geek Cred. Are you geek enough? To download and subscribe, visit www.geekcred.net and get your geek on.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
Yes, The Ragged Edge.
Mm-hmm.
I love that title.
I do too. I do too. It's very appropriate. It's, you know, it occurred to me after watching it again tonight that, pun intended, I suppose, it's a very sobering episode.
And I'm not sure what was going on in the B5 world or in the world in general at that time, but it dawned on me that the humor, the jokes in this, the humor in this episode is a lot more sly, biting, definitely biting, and sneaky. it's like the snark monster came out of the woodwork while JMS was asleep and just sort of subtly rearranged some of the commentary and just made it pissier.
Snarkier? Yeah.
Yeah, and funny. Yeah. It's hilarious.
Jakar, he is so unprepared for what awaits him, and I love the scene where he first comes back to the station with Londo.
Yeah.
And he confronts Talon, and as Talon, this is what I love. Here's Talon. Here's the warrior, okay? And he's definitely a warrior. And as he's telling this to Jakar, he's backpedaling the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
And then puts a piece of furniture between he and Jakar. It was like, oh.
And it actually starts out before then with Londo throwing barbs at Jakar as they're getting closer. He says, is it just me or are they looking at us? He says, no, they're looking at me. He says, oh, really? And then he uses that to launch into poking at Jakar.
You know what I noticed from this episode and from what you just said, it really, really highlighted it. It's like when one character is in a situation of discomfort, the other one realizes now's the time to pounce. You know, it's not like this empathy. I understand, you know, the pressures of having people look at you. It's like you're feeling really uncomfortable. Well, here, let me start throwing knives at you.
And that's, I don't know if that's a sign of at that moment in time, they were unable to be empathetic or understanding and just decided to cope by being funny, either through intentional reasons or not realizing the gravity of the situation. Because we know at the beginning, Londo has no idea and Jakar has no idea what has happened. We don't know yet. And he's just the glee in his face was like, 10 credits for you to be not here for an hour.
Yes.
That whole scene.
And for the rest of your life, well, they couldn't afford it.
That's hilarious. That whole bit. And he's got the wise ass grin on his face. It's so perfect. He's like, yeah.
Yeah, but it's interesting. You just said, you know, are they in a position where they don't have empathy for each other? I think there's one moment in this episode where we really do see suddenly how much concern Jakar has for Londo, at least in the scene where it's Jakar and Garibaldi and Delenn,
right,
and Sheridan after the mission's been screwed up, and we'll get to that I know soon, but when they're discussing what to do and the fact that it might be the Centauri involved, and it's like, well, do we tell Londo? And Jakar immediately pipes up, no, we can't, and here's
right.
why.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
And in the past, I think that Jakar would have said, let's dangle him out there as bait. You know, let's tell him some stuff to see if we can't. This was not that at all. This was very much, no, his life's already in danger, and we're not going to do anything more to endanger him. You know, and it was that genuine concern for a fellow sentient life form. And that really, I thought, was very significant and very stirring.
Yeah, that whole scene, there's a lot of weight in that scene. And we'll get to it in a minute.
Yeah. So to continue with the Book of Jakar, having been liberated,
yes. Yes, Talon's like literally staying as close to the door as he can.
Yeah.
Oh, that's, he's like, well, we didn't think you were coming back, so we took it, and a couple people read it, and they loved it, so they copied it. Is that copyright infringement? Is that piracy?
I don't, well, it depends. Did Jakar ever copyright it? Was it because it was on his desk and they figured it was gone? Did it fall into public domain instantly?
Right. It was an unfinished manuscript. It was, you could even say, a journal.
Yeah.
Something personal.
Yeah.
People knew he was writing a book. He just hadn't finished it yet. He said, I've been working on it for 2 years. And
yeah.
I like how, you know, he's like, well, a couple people read it and they made copies. Copies! You know, for their friends to read. Yeah.
How many? 500,000 or 600,000 Yeah, defeated. He just kind of sinks onto the sofa there.
And the funny thing was, the first time I saw this scene where Talon says, you have now become a religious icon, and yeah. And Jakar rolls his eyes in his head, the first thing that ran through my head was, are you a god? I don't know why Ghostbusters popped into my head when I saw that scene. He's like, you are now a religious icon. And I'm like, okay, Jakar's a god.
Yeah, maybe he's just the keymaster. But, you know, see, here's the thing. This is one of those things, though, as it goes on, where it becomes a sobering thing because, as you know, he's not coming out of his quarters and Talon goes in basically to dig him out. And Jakar is overwhelmed. It's like he embraces the concept of the spirituality of what he's discovered, but it's a whole other thing to have to deal with it on a more earthy plane, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, and his reasons are valid. You know, I don't want to be a teacher because I'm just this person, and what if I tell him the wrong thing? But on the other hand, I like it. Again, I don't think it's an inconsistency of character. It's just that he doesn't realize the ramifications of it. If you're writing this stuff down, then you have to think that it's going to have an impact somewhere.
Right. And I understand where he's coming from a writer's perspective. He's been working on it for 2 years. He didn't think it was finished.
Sure.
He wasn't done because it's not just a process of writing the content of the book. It was his journey, his internal journey to become ready to face the public with what he has said in this book. It was sort of like he would be ready when the book is finished or vice versa.
Right. Right.
And now he's been thrust on this stage completely unprepared and unsure about wanting to take up the responsibility of trying to guide the people who come to him with questions or looking for more guidance. And, you know, every time we see him go out, you see two or three people bowing, holding a copy of the book.
Yeah.
And he's just like, I can't do this. And then eventually Talon says, eventually you're going to have to do this. Why not start now?
And he tells him, you have a responsibility. You know, you have a tool. You've been given this gift to use. You know, and I liked his analogy. I've got this sword. I use it. It's put into service to other people for a purpose. You know, now what are you going to do with your tool? What are you going to do with your capability? And it's almost a challenge at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He's like, You've honed your gift. When are you going to use it?
Yeah. And then, like you say, why not now? But, you know, one of Jakar's biggest fears starts to come true even at the end of this episode. You know, he feels like the shadow of the teacher will become longer than the message. And he runs into that almost immediately with his first, I guess you would call it a public meeting where they're on the observation deck and he's teaching from the book of Jakar and put your face in the book.
Oh, there's so much going on in that scene that is just brilliant. And it should have been the end, but I know, you know, we know how JMS doesn't like happy, you know, happy upbeat endings, but this, that whole entire scene where he's explaining, you know, he's talking to the group and the one guy, the one stubborn guy.
Yeah, although there's a Narn in there as you pan across, he's got this look on his face like, I don't get it.
But the wording of his questions, he's talking to Jakar, and then he says, but in the book of Jakar, like the man Jakar and the holy book of Jakar aren't connected in any way.
Yeah, right. And that's interesting. See, that's one thing that I really picked up on in that scene this time around, is that the concept that and we see this in our own world, any given holy book, people look into those books to find the things that confirm what they already think they know. In other words, that guy latched on to what? The Centauri can't be trusted. You know, as Talon even says, you know, in the earlier scene, it's like, our, you know, all we know how to do is to hate and to fight. And we can't have that anymore. But here's an example of someone who all his life has been taught how to hate and fight. And what is he, what is the first thing he latches on to in the book of Jakar?
How to hate, you know, why not to trust the Centauri?
Right, exactly, exactly. And he ignores the other three quarters of the book. You know, and his logic is wonderful. It's that, well, if it's all in the book and the book is holy, how can this not be the holy word? And Talon's comment at the end after the thump, he says, herein's the first lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know he's directing it to, you know, at the guy with his nose in the book and the crowd in general, but you have to wonder if it was also, you could also see it as aimed at Jakar. You know, here's your first lesson.
Oh, I hadn't thought about that.
this is what you have to teach them.
No, but that the way he words that is, show me the passage in the book.
Yeah.
Put your face in the book.
And the guy's reluctant, like,
He says, no. We are taught that you cannot trust outsiders, but you can trust all Narn. Therefore, put your face in the book. And I went, huh, what's gonna, you know what's coming? You just don't know how the first time you see it.
Yeah.
And then you hear the crunch and the whimper in the background. With a good sound system, you can hear the, in the background.
It's very much like a Warner's cartoon where they throw the piano out the building, and you don't really need to see it hit to know that it's a wonderful bit of mayhem. Same deal here with this, yeah.
Yes, and that feeds back into the snarky humor of, you know, the increased level of snark in the whole episode, in the humor of the episode. Just put your face in the. Go ahead.
Yeah.
And that has probably got to be my favorite scene of season 5, or if it's not favorite, it's top 3.
Wow. Okay. I haven't even thought of it in those terms. I'll have to give that some thought. No, it's a classic. There's no doubt. Absolute classic. So now do we get to the real heavy stuff?
Sure.
Poor Garibaldi. You know what? It's one of those, I remember the first time seeing this episode when Talik, crap, I can't get it right, but his friend shows up at the...
Oh, Tafik. Tafik,
thank you. I just watched the episode. Tafik. And he shows up with a bottle. And Garibaldi, as he starts to pour it out, he's like, no. And the guy gives him this look, and it's just like, oh, as soon as he says, yeah, right, go ahead, yeah. It's like, oh, nothing good is going to come of this.
No, I was so hoping he could say, no, I'm not drinking. You know, I don't drink anymore.
Yeah,
and his friend would have understood.
That's exactly right. That's the shame of it. That's the shame of it. And in a very real way, I mean, you know, everyone's responsible for their own actions. But the fact is that they got hammered. And you just know at that point, Garibaldi's like, one more, come on. For old time's sake. Hey, you remember when? Blah. And, you know, and you know, and that's, I don't know, the whole thing just falls apart at that point. And Franklin knows that something's up. You know, and I don't know. It's just the part of the tragedy of that character's story. I don't, you know, and when he's in the meetings, you know, he's really being with it. You can tell, you know, he's rattling off facts and he's, here's what I'm thinking, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, but that's part of it too. You know, that's part of you know, when it's really important. When it's really important, he's not doing the right thing. And it's just...
Yeah, that it's, you know, you see the tragedy of it where he brushes it off when Zach calls and says, are you just, you know, did I wake you? He says, oh, yeah. I'm feeling bad. You know, I must be coming down with something. And then... I never could understand what the full reason was why he didn't want Steven to go along.
Well, it's obvious because he knows that there's that part of him in there. The alcoholic in him says when Tafik shows up, he's going to have a bottle with him.
He doesn't know that for sure because he seemed surprised. He seemed surprised by it when the bottle showed up. He's like, what is this? And he's like, hey, come on. He's like, what? No, okay.
No,
I do.
I. No. Believe me. There was, he would not have been able to articulate it. But that's the whole thing. That's the whole reason he doesn't want Steven along. Is because in the back of his mind, he either knows or is hoping that his buddy's going to show up with a bottle.
Hmm. I don't know about the nose that he will. Maybe the possibilities are. I thought he didn't want to see him drinking on the flight there. That's just me.
Yeah, but there was no indication that he had been drinking on the flight.
That's true.
You know, that was... And again, that's one of those things that you think that, you know, he's probably telling himself, well, I'm out on a mission. I'm not going to. But then the alcoholic part in him is sitting there going, gee, sure would be nice if my buddy showed up with a bottle of Drazi blue stuff.
Drazi blue stuff. I don't think it was quite so obvious as that. I think he might have been trying to avoid, you know, being in a situation where he would be alone with Steven and have to talk because he never went back to ask about the telepathic block. And Steven never brought it up again. It's like it slipped his mind, which to me is a tragedy.
Well, yeah. Yeah, but again, you know, Steven knows there's something up. And the reason he's asking, you know, are we okay?
But he never once asked him, do we still, you know, do you still need to talk to me about that telepathic block thing?
Oh, no, I know. But that by that point, see, in Steven's mind, that's all. I mean, I'm not saying that he's consciously thinking this either, but his thought is something screwy with Garibaldi, and it's the same kind of behavior that I was exhibiting when I was doing stims.
Okay, yeah.
And so, you know, everything else goes by the wayside. Are you okay? Are we okay? You know, if you got something on your mind, you can tell me. You know, and that's what it is. You know, Steven suspects. As he says, it's not, you know, your reasons made sense, but it's just the way you said it. Yeah. And Tafik ends up dead. The pilot that they're searching for ends up dead. Garibaldi is beaten within an inch of his life.
Oh, poor Garibaldi.
I know. I know, it really is. It's heartbreaking.
And Tafik, all he did was be at the wrong place at the wrong time.
Yeah.
Now, here's the question. Here's the question. Who killed Taufeeq? Was it the Drazi or was it the Centauri?
That's a really good question, because you never see the assailant. You want to assume it's the Drazi, because when Garibaldi comes out of the room, there is Drazi looking at his body.
Right. But it seemed like he had just come up on it and found it and was searching it, looking for something, like a data crystal with the information, maybe.
Right. I agree with you. I would lean toward the Centauri doing in Taufeeq. Of course, that only begs the question. At that point, why didn't they just break into Garibaldi's room and do
kill
him
both of them? Right. True.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I'm curious, because remember later when they talk about certain races use certain blasters in certain color zones?
Right.
We saw that the plasma blast that hit Taufeeq was blue. Do we know if that was from a Drazi weapon or a Centauri weapon? And I'm trying to remember some of the battles we saw, like the shootouts we saw in the with Centauri palace guards.
Gold.
I can't remember. They were gold.
Yeah, but I'm thinking like when Londo he's got Morden there in the palace. He has the guards shoot to either side to kill the Morden shadow.
All right.
Escort.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's gold, but I mean that doesn't prove anything either.
True.
You know,
because
I mean,
I know in the right, and because I would like to find out for sure if that was a clue as to who might have done it, because we see in like a few minutes later when Garibaldi comes up on them just after they've killed the pilot, when he's fighting them, you actually see
a Centauri.
You can weapon, tell, yeah, you can tell from the elongated barrel that it's a Centauri weapon right in that moment. You know, you don't know who it is, and you see Garibaldi look at the button in his hand afterwards. But in that one moment when they're running away, when Garibaldi's down, and why they don't shoot him there, I don't know. But you see the long barrel of the Centauri guard weapon, and that's when you know that's a Centauri weapon.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I mean, now let's explore that further. Why not kill Garibaldi at that moment? I mean, if you're already attacking the Alliance, I mean, if you're really trying to frame all the various Alliance members, you know, turning them one against the other, what better way? You kill the head of intelligence for the entire Interstellar Alliance on the Drazi homeworld.
Right.
Okay. Boy, what? I mean, if there was any perfect picture frame to put around somebody, that would be it. You already suspect them of doing something anyways, the Drazi. You know, you know that you can't get the pilot off the planet because the Drazi, you know, the government doesn't want to do it officially because, you know, he was running illegal stuff in for them. Okay? Kill Garibaldi. Oh, my God. Then you take all the heat off the Centauri.
Yeah. Especially if he was found dead beside the guy he had come to get.
Yep, exactly. Precisely, because then the story is, well, that Garibaldi and the guy hooked up, and the Drazi police came along and killed them both at the same time.
To protect Drazi interests, because they were, you know, still handling illegal illegal materials.
Well, on the other hand, I mean, here, let's play it from the other side of that. Maybe part of that was a message. Because the other thing you notice, that the pilot wasn't killed by a PPG type weapon. He looked like he'd been beaten to death.
No, there was a sound of a shot before he screamed, like right before Garibaldi came around the corner to get him.
But his face was bloody and there was blood on the wall.
He was definitely manhandled before being shot.
Yeah. Right. So I mean that's the other part of it is you kick the head of the Interstellar Alliance around, and that's a message to say, you know, we don't care who you send after us.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Or maybe it was just a mistake.
Yeah, maybe they took their orders too literally. You know, they didn't have permission, or they weren't denied. They weren't told not to kill anybody else. They weren't told that they could kill anybody else. So they might not have known who Garibaldi was. They were just sent out there.
They could have just been guys sent on the mission. Yeah. Jeez, it's the cops. And they take off running.
Some other human who's wandering around, you know, that doesn't play if they're the ones who killed Taufeeq, But if they're not the ones who killed Taufeeq, and how they would have gotten from the balcony down to the park so quickly, I mean, the fight Garibaldi had with the one Drazi does not make up for that difference in time, because he was already dead by the time he got there.
Yeah.
So maybe there was two groups, if indeed Taufeeq was killed by Centauri assassin team.
Well, and there could also have been all kinds of factions in the Drazi as well. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
How about that Superman jump that Garibaldi does in the street? He was airborne for a long time. And I don't care if you got the $6 million man slow motion thing going on. So let's see what else we got. The other bit in terms of sobering from a more meta standpoint, Stephen Franklin getting the job offer to become head of xenobiology at Earth Dome. And, you know, as a fan, I remember this. You know, it was the last year. You'd already gone through all the other seasons, not knowing whether or not the show is coming back. The whole deal with year four, this is it. Wrap it all up, and then you get the joy of one last year, and you know it's the last year, but when Franklin tells Sheridan, I'm taking the job, and I'm leaving B5, it really was kind of like bringing it home that the thing was wrapping up.
It's slowly ending. It's taking that long, slow walk towards final wrap.
The characters are starting to go off. The fellowship is starting to break up and go off in different directions.
The fellowship,
you know, and it was really that kind of like, wow, they're not all sticking around for one big last grand adventure. It's like, I got a job offer and I'm going to take it. Now I'll be here for a while, but I'm going to leave. You know, I mean, it was just, it's all that kind of stuff. It's like, wow, wait a minute.
Life moves on. And the way. Exactly. The disappointment on Sheridan's face is just primal. He's, oh man, my friend's leaving.
Yeah, but happy for him in the end. You know, he's honest with him. It's like, I can't tell you I'm happy about this.
Right. Yeah, yeah. He had that moment when he was four. He was 4 year old again. He's like, oh man,
it was a very petulant look. He was just like, really, you know, in a day where so much has gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this was the capstone.
Yeah.
But damn it.
Yeah.
I like that. But it was, you know, it was a good scene too. And that uncomfortable bit where it winds down, you know, Sharon stands up, shakes his hand, there's smiles, and then it's like, okay, now what do I say? Because now it's like that little thread is already broken.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like the relationship has already changed in that one moment. It's just, it's so, again, it's emotional. It's very sobering.
There's one scene that I would have liked to have seen in there, and we missed it. We didn't get a shot at it. I don't know whether it was thought of and they didn't have time to film it or they thought it would be excess. A scene with Garibaldi back in Med Lab with Steven tending to his many, many battle injuries.
Yes, right.
And there would have been prime opportunity for just an extra little bit of snarky commentary. You know it. You know it would have been.
Yeah, yeah. Makeup on Jerry Doyle was fantastic in this episode.
Yeah, that the whoever did his makeup on that shot where he's calling Delenn over the comms. He looked like Dead Man Walking.
Yeah. Are you okay? No, not really.
Yeah. Whoever did the makeup around his one eye, I swear that could be like, you know, stage one of zombie infection. You know, we're talking, you know, 12 more hours. We got full on zombie Garibaldi.
Garizombie.
I like that. that's funnier than it should be. Garizombie.
Yeah, no, it was very visceral what he went through. So the mystery gets bigger and deeper, and this is one of those things. Again, this is why I like season 5. Is like, we knew all about the big shadow arc, and there was the, you know, the Earth Civil War and all the rest. And then you're left with this, well, what can he, stories can he tell? And the season seems to start off semi-meandering. And then just these things just start kind of precipitating out of the ether. What else? Anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Yeah, I think this is one of those episodes where it's setting the stage for bigger and darker things.
Yeah, the attitude when Londo recognizes the button and they all just shut up.
Yes.
It literally, you can feel, even through the screen, you can feel the entire mood of the room go cold.
Yeah. Yeah, and Londo just has no clue.
No clue, but just the way that they all shut down, and you could feel the chill go over the room just from their body language. That's some stuff like that is wonderful.
Yeah, yeah, great acting. That's when the characters really come alive, when all the nonverbals tell you that. And you know, Peter Jurassic, we know, is a marvelous actor as Londo, but to not, as an actor, to not respond to that, you know, and to still play like you don't know what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because he's still happy, you know, everything in his life is
well,
better.
Mr. Garibaldi, you have been taken. You know, Londo's whole thing is like, well, the button is basically worthless.
Yeah.
But it's like the fat clue that they've got all of a sudden. You know, Londo just basically said, oh, yeah, by the way, you know, without knowing it, you know, here's the big hook for the mystery.
What do you do? All right.
Take it up in the next episode.
Did we cover everything?
I think we did.
Yes. Put your face in the book.
Here ends the first lesson.
Oh, that is so classic. I think we need to find out if there's an appropriate song that we can do an alternative lyrics to for that with Put Your Face in the Book. There has to be.
All right. That's a chat room thing.
That is a chat room thing. We'll get the information to them and see what they come up with. But for now, we'll take a really quick break. And I believe you have some emails.
Yeah, sure do.
All right.
I've been all over this crazy globe in my time. Rome, London, been to Nice, and the Isles of... Well, I spent some time in Scotland. I even visited Sunnydale. Managed to get away with just a missing ear, which wasn't too bad considering what happened to most. A few weeks ago, I was planning to leave the US of A. You know, skip on a boat to some dark little place where I could just hide out for a while. I was almost packed when my brother calls me and says, you're going to get on a bus and you're going to come to L.A. And I say, you're kidding, right? With that freak running around in his leather coat just waiting to stick some sharp implement in me? No way! But then he says that the dear old Defender of Grace hasn't been seen in a few weeks. There are even rumors he's been killed. So what could I say? I got on the next bus and I can tell you, I have been having a wonderful time. The streets are full of people just waiting to be dragged in a dingy alley, and with everyone on stupid diets, there is quite a library of tastes going around. It's the best time of my unlife. So there we are. Angels missing, and you know what they say. When the angels are away, the demons will play.
Demons will play. Really.
You got her, Connor?
Of course I got her. And stop yelling, amateurs.
Join the party and listen to Angel Between the Lines at angelbetweenthelines.com.
Returning again from the Ragged Edge.
Yes, into the Dragged Edge. I don't know.
Into the abyss of listener feedback.
Yeah, we got a few emails here we didn't get around to from last week. So, we have
emails on the left of us, voicemails on the right of us.
If I was a delete button, what would I be? Okay, this comes to us. The first one comes to us from Carlos in Champaign, Illinois. He writes, I just want to make a comment about the Drac with the big glowing red eyes. Is it possible that the creative team inherently knew that somewhat cliched look the original Drac appearances and slowly introduced the Wayne Alexander type Drac as a way of retconning the situation? I honestly don't remember enough of Crusade to say whether or not other Drac variations appeared. I was originally under the impression that the Drac were actually a number of races working together. I didn't mind it so much as the entire structure of the scene for me was at least a very "what the heck was that?" moment when I originally saw it. But for the most part, I did not feel as if I were being nibbled to death by cats. I absolutely love this episode for the tone and pacing. Love it. I wonder if it's one of those things that when you go all the way back and you've got the you got the dancing Drac on the Minbari starship and they're going, "Oh god, well that didn't work." And so they got another Drac, give them glowing red eyes, and "Oh god, well that didn't work." And they just kind of went at it that way. I don't know.
I put them in the same bucket with the alien creature, how you've got several different types of alien. You got the queen, you've got the hunter drones, you've got the collectors. They're different model aliens. So there's right. different models of the Drac. Kind of like you've got three casts of Minbari. They still sure. they look similar but different. There are different classes of Drac. You've got the messenger ones who have obviously spent too much time in hyperspace.
Or at a disco.
You've got the science Drac who look very, very different from the others. You know, the ones where you saw like doing the implant thing or the implant prep on the Regent and on Mondo. Yeah. You've got the ones that have the keepers. Right. You know, I'm thinking those guys are, you know, middle management somewhere along the line.
Okay.
And there's probably some top level Drac who we never see. That's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, I mean it's as viable as anything else. You know, part of it gets down to it's the same argument as, you know, why do Klingons have head ridges and not? It ultimately boils down to the fact that it's on a television show with limited funds and under the gun on production. So, you know,
they had 5 hours less shooting time that week, so the ridges had to be toned down. I don't know.
Right. Or you know, it was, okay, well, they knew the dancing Drac didn't work. You know, it was a great idea, guys, but it just didn't come across. We got a script of the Drac. Oh, crap, it's shooting this afternoon? Put glowing red eyes on it. That's creepy enough. And you know, we're on to the next problem. You know, I mean, it's that kind of a thing. So, you know, and meanwhile, they know the guys back at the studio are working up the Wayne Alexander mask that's going to be good for close-ups and whatever else. And I'm trying to remember from the Technomage trilogy, because there was a number of scenes, obviously, on Zahadum and getting in closer to Zahadum. And I know there were Drac mentioned, but I'm just trying to remember if it was that there were multiple Drac or just multiple agents of the shadows, the Drac being one of them.
Yeah, I from all I remember hearing was Drac was only one of the races who were servants of the shadows.
Right. Right. And that's not to say there aren't multiple Dracs in, you know, the Drac species. It's just, I guess we just don't know it. I don't remember enough anyways to say definitively one way or the other. So, all right, here comes the next one. This is comes to us from Greg from Australia. He says, "Hi, fellow Babylonians. I'm a bit behind listening, but I just listened to episode 166 where you mentioned Leeta's enhanced abilities and her display of those abilities. It is possible that it would be easier for her to control the Zocalo full of mundanes as opposed to a Psycop, since the Psycops are trained to push back where the mundanes would have no defense against her abilities. Also, it would probably be in her best interest to show a big display of force, such as in the Zocalo, so that everyone would think twice about bringing in someone who would be capable of pushing back." And then he goes on to talk about, okay, now this is just silly, but I'll go with it. goes on to talk about how you could do a reboot film of Babylon 5 without actually rebooting the series. He says JMS could do a film with a whole new crew on B5, but set in the future of the series. They could then have some of the original cast come back in cameos or to add that character into the storyline. Some friends and I had put on our own cast together when the B5 movie was first mentioned back during season 4 or 5. The cast had ended up with mostly 80s action heroes taking over the roles of the cast for blockbuster movie. Bruce Willis would be Garibaldi because his hair gets shorter over his career as well. And the best actor to play Johnny Newcomb Sheridan, of course, would have to be Arnold Schwarzenegger. Just imagine Arnie yelling out, "Get the hell out of our galaxy!"
Okay, that's just supreme silliness.
Well, you think that's silly? Here we go. Here's the next one. This comes to us from Mike in New York. And he passes on the IMDb listing for Austin Powers. In the Las Vegas bar scene, I'm quoting here, when in the Las Vegas bar scene where Austin flashes the peace sign and is laughed at, Mike Myers originally wanted Austin to be drinking a Zima to show Powers desperately trying to be cool and failing. In the movie, he's drinking a Tab. The Zima company was keen on the idea until they realized they were being mocked and quickly pulled out.
Aww.
So Mike writes, one has to wonder if something similar happened on B5. The sign was supposedly put in B5 as a joke as well, and it's not hard to imagine Zima not realizing that until later and not letting B5 use the name again. Man, I could go for an ice cold Zima right about now.
Don't go there.
All right, here comes the last one. This is comes to us from Hayden in Toronto. And he writes, Tim suggested that JMS was not an atheist because he would not put a sympathetic character like Brother Theo into the show. However, I believe that JMS is a self-described atheist and presumably thus a free thinker as well. For a reference, I point to an online version of the Lurker's Guide, and in the episode Passing Through Gethsemane, JMS writes, quote, one caveat here overall, it's been complimented and commented upon that I would expose a belief system in my show which I do not personally agree with, presenting the face of religion even though I'm an atheist. That I could be this tolerant is apparently praiseworthy. I would just suggest that at some point, when and if I should offer a point of view from another perspective, which one watching might not personally agree with, the same tolerance is given, since the virtue of tolerating divergent attitudes has been deemed praiseworthy and is something ever to strive for.
Hmm.
Well, I remember my comments and what I based this on. It was two things. One is from my own personal experience, atheists tend to be just as dogmatic and zealous in their belief system as any religious fundamentalist type. Okay.
Yes.
And so based on that, I would not think it likely that an atheist would give you such, you know, Brother Theo would be a straw man to set up and knock over. You know, when the Reverend Dexter comes to talk to Sheridan about God's plan, you know, Sheridan would push that straw man over. That's just personal experience here, all right? The other part of it is, I recall a post from JMS where he comments to say that he doesn't ascribe to a particular religion, but he said if there was anything that came closest to what his own personal belief system, it might be Buddhism. Now, I did about a whole 2 minutes worth of research trying to find that and couldn't come up with it. So, you know, at that point, JMS's comment as a self-described atheist has to stand because, you know, I'm not refuting that. Don't get me wrong. You know, my comment was just based on my own personal belief system, frankly. So there you are.
Okay.
All right. I just find that interesting. I think, you know, whatever else you say about the story, that's, I think, is one of the strengths of Babylon 5 and Straczynski's writing in general, is that even-handedness, if it's, you know, anyway.
Yeah, I think it's more of a writer trying to be more, trying not to use his story as a soapbox.
Sure.
You know, because he might have gone a little bit that way with the political strife on Earth at the beginning. Maybe, just maybe. But it's not about the creator, the writer. It's about the story. And if you can write a story where your own personal beliefs don't drown out the message of the greater story,
right,
you've accomplished a great deal.
Well, you know, I mean, Straczynski had his own, you know, he had his own messages he was trying to get across, you know, the power of the individual, never surrender dreams.
Right, but they weren't, you know, personal agendas. They were, right, you know, they were exactly. Higher, they were loftier goals than that, loftier messages than that. You know, they weren't personal agendas, like, this is what I think, and I think you should think this too, kind of thing.
Right, right, right.
Because those kind of stories get tedious.
Yeah, because you're not going to convince anybody when you start getting that way about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
I think that's it for tonight.
It is. I miss the Vorlon.
We all do.
I know.
But he's off doing good work.
He is. Okay. Well, you know the drill. The website is BabylonPodcast.com. If you have your own email to submit to the fray, that address is BabylonPodcast@gmail.com. If you want to join in the never-ending thread over at the never-ending 83x9x12 thread over at the forums, that is over at farpointforums.com. And, of course, if you want to call in your own voicemail, that phone number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
Here, your friend showed up with a bottle of stuff that you shouldn't be drinking.
And we'll see you next time on the other side of the pink elephants.